This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The environmental problems we're facing today are more complex than those of 40 years ago, and implementing solutions seem more challenging. For the last four decades, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has sought to provide effective responses to many of these issues. Now, as science advances, EPA is working to address the increasing complexity of 21st century environmental challenges with solutions that are effective, efficient, and sustainable. Solutions that are designed to meet the current needs while minimizing potential human health and environmental risks into the future. What is EPA doing to incorporate sustainability into its regulatory decision-making? How is it pursuing a path forward in developing solutions to the nation's top environmental challenges? And why is EPA involved in green chemistry research? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator for Research and Development at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Paul, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Oh, what a pleasure to be here today. Thanks for having me.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Ken Beecher. Ken, welcome.
Thanks.
Paul, before we delve into specific initiatives, perhaps you could provide a brief overview in history and evolution of the EPA's Office of Research and Development. When was it created and how has it evolved in its mission?
Well, the Office of Research and Development, which we often call ORD for short, was actually started 40 years ago, back at the beginning of the EPA. And it was a recognition that everything that we do at the EPA needs to be science-based. And so it started out with a core group of scientists, a few of which are still with us today. It has since grown to close to 2,000 federal employees with labs all across the country. So we're looking at how we get the right scientific foundation for all of the decisions and the actions of the EPA.
So operationally, with such an interesting mission, how is your office organized? What's the size of its budget and number of employees?
So the entire budget for the Office of Research and Development is, I think about $580 million for the fiscal year 2011. We do have about 2,000 employees, scientists, engineers of all types. We focus on such a wide range of topics. Obviously, air pollution, water contamination, toxic chemicals, ecosystem relationships, and all of the intersections between those. And all of it is geared toward the EPA mission of protecting human health and the environment.
So would you tell us more about your dual role as Assistant Administrator for EPA's ORD and your role as Science Advisor? What are your specific responsibilities and duties, and how do you support EPA's overall mission?
So my role as Assistant Administrator for the Office of Research and Development oversees the wide range of research programs that we have, everything from basic studies on the toxicity of chemicals all the way to technology development for purifying water. The role as the science advisor for the agency, and more specifically the science advisor to the administrator, is to ensure that science is at the table on every question, on every issue that we address, that science is an essential piece. Now, many of the questions that we address have broad components to them. There can be important economic considerations, important legal considerations. But one of the things that President Obama has made clear, one of the things that Administrator Jackson has made clear, is that science and the law are integral parts of all we do. And so this is a way of ensuring and that the administrator ensures that science is at the table at every decision.
Interesting. So regarding your responsibilities and duties, and you just discussed a little bit or a lot about the research programs, what are the three top challenges that face that you face in your position, and how are you addressing these challenges?
Well, it's interesting because when I first came on board, when I was first asked to serve in this position, I do, as is my habit, I guess, saw the opportunities rather than the challenges, and I probably saw the challenges as opportunities. So there's a 40-year history at EPA of deeply understanding the nature of the environmental problems we face, whether it is the contaminants that are in our water, or the pollution going into our air, or the toxicity of chemicals, and we are, I would say, the best in the world at deeply understanding the nature of those problems. What the question is how do we use that deep knowledge, how do we use that deep understanding of the problems in order to inform and empower the solutions? So it's one thing to say things are, you know, this bad, or, you know, we need to do things X percent better. It's another thing to say, these are some of the approaches that can be taken in order to address not only our air, water, land issues, but how we do them synergistically so that we meet environmental and economic goals simultaneously for societal benefit. That is the great challenge, and I'd probably put that as challenge 1, 2, and 3 on how we integrate all of those.
Right, so it seems to me that you love solving challenges and you're embracing it. So along with being known as the father of green chemistry, you've had a very interesting career, right? Could you describe your career path for our listeners and how you began your career and how where you see yourself now seeing these opportunities and challenges?
Well, I only joke slightly when I say that I'm a simple country chemist. I am a trained chemist, but when people ask me what brought me into chemistry, it was actually my love of the environment. I grew up just south of Boston on a beautiful wetland, on a hill overlooking a beautiful wetland. And if you go to the house where I grew up today, you won't see that because the bulldozers rolled in while I was around, I'd say 8-10 years old. And you'll now see very large glass and concrete buildings housing banks and insurance companies. And I was a heartbroken young man, son of a biology teacher, that told me that if you truly care about something, if you really love something, you care about it enough to learn about it. And so that brought me into science, brought me into chemistry. And I took as my first position out of graduate school after receiving my PhD, position at the Environmental Protection Agency, where I wound up heading up the industrial chemistry branch of EPA, where we did some interesting things back in the day before I went off to work in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy for, I guess, 5 years there, before heading up something called the Green Chemistry Institute, a not-for-profit scientific society around the subject of green chemistry. Well, both myself as well as my wife then moved to Yale University to join the faculty, where we opened the Center for Green Chemistry and Green Engineering at Yale, which is one focused on solutions and environmental challenges, where you meet, as we were talking about earlier, environmental and economic goals simultaneously. And then the call came from Washington, and I thought the opportunity was to make a positive impact was too good to say no. And it's been an honor to work with the people of EPA and ORD.
So, Paul, given your experience, what are the characteristics of an effective leader?
Well, I think perhaps more than anything else is understanding what is motivating individuals, both as individuals and as a collective workforce, and explaining the actions that need to be taken in terms of those motivations. And more specifically, the Office of Research and Development has over 2,000 scientists, has about 2,000 scientists. The agency has over 6,000 scientists and engineers. When you have scientists and engineers, one thing you have is a diversity of opinion on how things should be done. Now, the one unifying factor across those folks is the dedication, the passionate dedication to the mission of the agency, to protect human health and the environment. When you can explain how the actions that we're seeking to take, how the strategies we're seeking to employ make us more effective at accomplishing that mission, then you can mobilize a workforce of brilliance to make some great things happen. And so I think perhaps the key insight is to see where is the passion, where's the unifying passion.
I'd like to know who has influenced your leadership style and management approach.
Perhaps more than anyone else, it would have to be my father. While I lost my father very young, he had the enduring influence on me on how to combine analytical skills and empathetic skills and working with people and understanding what problems need to be addressed. I also had a wonderful mentor during my first years at EPA named Roger Garrett. He's one of the most brilliant people that I had encountered during that time. And sadly, we lost him as well.
What is EPA doing to incorporate sustainability into its regulatory decision-making? We will ask Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator for Research and Development at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What are the seven management imperatives all government executives need to know? How is DoD improving its business operations? What is FAA's next generation air transportation system, or NextJet? How is New York City shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And what about power, security, and leadership in the 21st century? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator for Research and Development at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Ken Beecher. Paul, sustainability is quite important, and EPA has made many efforts to organize programs around sustainability. Could you tell us how EPA is incorporating sustainability, that theme, into its decision-making within the agency?
So one of the things that we've done in the Office of Research and Development is taking a step back and taking a look at the research programs that we've had ongoing. All of them are ones that have been reviewed and assessed over the years, doing excellent work, producing excellent science. But there's a question that we want to ask ourselves. Can we become even more effective by ensuring that these are mutually reinforcing? Are we getting the synergisms that we could be getting if we looked at things from a more systematic and systems approach? And that's really at the heart of sustainability, that very seldom do the environmental challenges that we're looking at divide themselves neatly into an air project or a water project. And so we are stepping back and have reoriented and realigned the entirety of the research portfolio, so taking this systems approach in order to understand the questions that we're addressing and the way we define our problems in terms of sustainable systems.
So I actually was wondering, what kind of scientific or analytic tools are needed to support this new operational framework?
Well, it's interesting because we went to the National Academy of Sciences last year to ask almost that exact question. How do we make sustainability operational at the EPA? And they've recently come out with a report called EPA and Sustainability, and it's sometimes referred to as the Green Book. And it lays a framework out of what are the analytical tools that either are available today or need to be developed in order to address our question systematically. It's one that's a great report that I would recommend to all of your listeners. Things like life cycle analysis, and not only current cost-benefit analysis, but thinking through future costs and generational costs, and things like green chemistry and green engineering tools.
All right, Paul, you mentioned green chemistry. It's groundbreaking research. You are a pioneer in advancing green chemistry. But what is green chemistry, and would you highlight some of the 12 principles of green chemistry?
Certainly. So green chemistry really is the scientific topic that I've devoted my professional life to. In a sentence, green chemistry is defined as the design of chemical products and processes that reduce or eliminate the use and generation of hazardous substances. So more than anything else, it's a design protocol to ensure that we get all of the function that we want from our products, we get all of the capabilities and performance that we want from our products, but not the unintended consequences of excessive waste and toxicity and risk that has been historically a part of the products of modern life. And so this is something that's been developed over the past, 20 years. And there are networks around the world and research networks in over 30 countries. There's now 4 scientific journals devoted to the topic. It's being taught in universities around the world. You can even get a PhD in green chemistry. And so, but I think most importantly what's happened is that this has been adopted by virtually every industry sector, ranging from energy and transportation to agriculture and plastics and everything in between. And so that's the good news, is that it's shown that you can make environmental and economic progress at the same time through thoughtful design. I think the better news is that they're scratching the surface of the power and the potential of green chemistry. So for every one product that has been reinvented and redesigned, there are probably hundreds that have yet to go through this protocol. So I think the upside is very high, and some market analysts have projected by the year 2020, the green chemistry sector itself will be a multi-billion dollar industry. So the 12 principles of green chemistry really do focus on not only the efficiency of a process, how you use less energy, how you generate less waste, but also the inherent nature of whether or not something's renewable, whether or not something's toxic. And it is used, as I said, as a design protocol to ensure that we're doing not only innovation, but we're doing innovation that's sustainable.
What are some of the examples of green chemistry in action? Could you give us some examples of where that redesign happened? And how does it, pursuing this approach, how does it support your overall sustainability mission?
So certainly, one of the things that that we see is that, for instance, in the area of solvents that are currently used in industry, solvents can be used in anything from cleaning to separating out products from waste and manufacturing processes, but they're also the highest volume and highest regulated substances. The area of coming up with alternative solvents is a very big thrust area for green chemistry historically, and there's been such projects as substituting liquid carbon dioxide, which you get from putting it under pressure and temperature, as a solvent for dry cleaning clothes, moving away from other solvents that might have certain health concerns associated with them. This is something that's now been taken from the research bench into commercialization, and there are dry cleaners who are doing this. It's just one example among many that we could talk about. Bio-based feedstocks and degradable plastics. As I said, virtually every industry sector is pursuing this. This is an essential element in assuring that, again, this goal of meeting environmental goals, human health goals, is coupled with profitability, competitiveness, and economic benefit. Too often, folks have been under the misconception, the myth, that we can't have both. It's a choice between one and the other. Green chemistry is belying that myth every day. And showing that, yes, it's been demonstrated that you can do this through thoughtful design.
So as a follow-up to that, Dr. Anastas, and you just mentioned health goals and health effects of communicating that information on chemicals to the public through the use of various means, through the use and disposal of various means. Would you tell us more about EPA's IRIS program, or the Integrated Risk Information System?
Certainly. The Integrated Risk Information System is a program that we use to understand all of the scientific information on various chemicals and communicate that in the form of a database to the public. This is something that's, yes, used in our regulatory programs, but it's also tremendously informative to industry. It's tremendously informative to the public, where we now have a database of over 500 IRIS chemicals that it provide the hazard information that can be used in such things as risk assessment. So it's a tremendously important program and one that we focus a tremendous amount of attention on and have made investments in terms of both people and funding in recent years.
Right. So you've mentioned the category of the chemicals within the IRIS program, and tens of thousands of chemicals are currently in commerce now. Hundreds more introduced every year, but only a fraction of those chemicals have been addressed adequately for potential risk. Would you tell us more about EPA's Computational Toxicology Research Program and how it employs advanced computer models?
Absolutely. CompuTox, for short, computational toxicology, is one of those groundbreaking research efforts that we have ongoing. As you mentioned, the ability to generate the toxicological data has historically taken maybe even a couple of years and many millions of dollars in order to get the necessary data. What computational toxicology or CompuTox is doing is using high-throughput screening methods, meaning rapid testing of a wide range, hundreds of bioassays, in order to get information much more quickly, not for one or 10 chemicals, but thousands of chemicals, literally, at perhaps as little as 1% of the cost. So this is revolutionizing the way that we think about it. Now, this is still in the research stage, but we're moving forward with this aggressively because we think it really can change the equation on understanding and getting the insights on the hazards that certain chemicals might pose. Now, one of the things that we always think about is how do we ensure that our understanding of problems informs and empowers solutions? This is a great example of how we not just know more about more chemicals in terms of why they're a problem, but how this information, how this dramatic treasure trove of information can be used in informing and empowering next generation design of chemicals. So instead of trying to assess how bad things are, design them so they're at least as least hazardous as possible.
So Dr. Anastas, you just mentioned about the next gen of, you know, future opportunities, possibilities of VPA. So obviously risk assessment is an integral part of the mission. Would you tell us more about your efforts in the human health research to advance risk assessment capabilities?
Oh, absolutely. So since risk assessment really became codified and integrated into EPA programs almost 30 years ago, it has become the backbone of many of the decisions that are made and is embedded in a number of statutes. And yet it's a constantly evolving science being refined. And one of the things that the Office of Research and Development is working on is how do we understand risk assessment, not in terms of only your exposure to one chemical and what then the probability of an adverse consequence or a disease might be, but how do we understand things like cumulative risk and aggregate risk? So exposure to a number of different chemicals, because we are all exposed to quite a few chemicals during the day. How do we understand that and build that into our risk assessment paradigm? Aggregate risk, where it's not just the stressors that we get from chemicals, but other types of stressors that we encounter in our environment. This is an important emerging area, and it becomes profoundly important for how we integrate it into our programs on things like environmental justice and disproportionately impacted communities. We know that there are communities that do bear a disproportionate impact of the consequences of exposure to toxic chemicals, for instance. To do a good job of assessing that and generating the solutions, these next-gen models of risk are going to be necessary.
And can you talk a little bit about the advancing the next generation of a risk assessment program?
That that program is the embodiment of these refinements to our risk models. Now, these the efforts that we're making build on some of the excellent work done by the National Academies in the so-called Silver Book, Risk and Decisions, that came out of that. And so that program is focusing on the refinements to the risk assessment paradigm.
Paul, I'd like to delve more into your systems approach. And in particular, in preparation for this interview, I did research and recognized that you are fond of a quote by Albert Einstein around problems and awareness. Could you elaborate on systems approach and how you're fundamentally changing the way you address a problem?
Yeah. You're absolutely right. One of my favorite quotes is, problems can't be solved at the same level of awareness that created them. And so the level of awareness that I'm often referring to is that the great accomplishments of science over the past 200 years that has given us the deep understanding of the world around us, that's given us the products of modern life, communications and transportation, these approaches have been basically reductionist approaches. Reductionist meaning you fairly narrowly define a problem and hold all things constant except that one thing that you're changing, and that gives you a very deep understanding. Now, that is absolutely essential. It's bedrock to many of the advances, and I would suggest insufficient alone. What we also need is an integrative approach, how we understand how these different systems interact with systems in very complex ways. Because many of the times when we only look at a reductionist approach is where we wind up with unintended consequences. When we wind up generating energy, for instance, but wind up causing various types of pollution, where we generate new technologies that may accomplish one function but wind up being a problem for our air or human reproductive goals. So the systems approach is just saying, let's step back, look at both the narrow focus that we're intending to accomplish, the narrowly defined performance that we're trying to accomplish, but also see how it interacts with the broader world, how it might have consequences for humans and the environment.
How is EPA pursuing a path forward in developing solutions to the nation's top environmental challenges? We will ask Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator for Research and Development at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen? How is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security turning its one DHS vision into reality? What is New York City doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And how is the DoD improving its business operations? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, DHS Undersecretary for Management Raphael Boris, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations Stephen Goldsmith, and Dave Winogrand, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at DoD. Professor Joseph Nye and General Anthony Zinni on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century, and seven management imperatives that government leaders should pursue to be successful in an era of fiscal constraint. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator for Research and Development at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Ken Beecher. Paul, science is the backbone for EPA's decision-making. All your efforts depend on the integrity of science you pursue. How are you promoting a culture of scientific integrity at EPA?
That's a great question, because this is something that President Obama has spoken to directly. The president's science advisor, John Holdren, has emphasized its importance, and Administrator Jackson has said that this is the foundation of all that we do. Scientific integrity is indeed the backbone of EPA work, and one of the things that we're proud of at EPA and in the Office of Research and Development is that we have a wonderful foundation and tradition of scientific integrity. One of the things that we have always done is ensure that, first and foremost, scientific misconduct, if it were ever to be taken place, is something that is taken extremely seriously and never never tolerated. I think it's fair to say that for areas of scientific misconduct, which is the most egregious element of scientific integrity, things like ever encountering falsification of data or plagiarism would be absolutely zero tolerance by anyone in the scientific community. And so that's certainly there. But more importantly, how do we get the assurance that our science is of the highest quality, the highest integrity? And we have both internal and external systems in place that ensure things like peer review, our board of scientific counselors, our scientific advisory board, the extensive peer reviews that we do ensure that scientific integrity is of the highest quality. But what we're also very excited about is that while we have a great foundation, the latest efforts by Administrator Jackson and Dr. Holdren and the president is building on that foundation and taking it to the next level to ensure that we are always going to have the systems in place to ensure that systematically that we ensure that science as it's developed, the science as it's used is of the highest quality, that the public access of our scientists to speak freely on their scientific expertise and on their scientific reports is something that is valued and promoted and ensured. So the new science integrity plans, scientific integrity plans, are already in the public for review, going final, and it just is part of the tradition where we continue to raise the bar and ensuring that scientific integrity is first and foremost in our endeavors at EPA.
Well, Paul, I'd like to transition to nanotechnology, both the positives and possible negatives of nanotechnology. As I understand it, EPA leads the federal government in planning research directions for the environmental application and impact of nanotechnology and nanomaterial, that is, material made at the nano level. What is nanotechnology, and what are some of the key research areas being pursued in EPA's nanotechnology program?
So nanotechnology is an exciting area of innovation. It is the realization that if we take ultra-small particles, particles that are perhaps 1/10,000th the size of a human hair, that by designing these particles and engineering these particles, they give you new properties, new performance, new capabilities that cannot be attained by just the bulk material. Nano gold, nano silver, other constructed nanoparticles have tremendously exciting new properties and potential. So that is the science of nanotechnology that's being explored in laboratories around the United States and around the world. What the EPA does, as it always does, is looks to ensure that the innovations that can be derived from this new science is going to be done in a way that will not in any way hinder its development because of unanticipated hazards or risks. And so the programs at EPA are to better understand the ways that people could be exposed to nanosubstances, whether or not they're toxic under certain circumstances. And so it's that understanding of the potential impacts of nanotechnology that the Office of Research and Development focuses upon.
And I'd like to drill down a little bit as a follow-on. Would you elaborate on some new research to better understand how manufactured nanomaterials may harm human health and the environment?
So the question is whether or not these materials are capable of under normal circumstances where we might interact with them, whether they're capable of causing a problem or capable of causing a risk. So that would mean, for instance, can we inhale these substances? Can they get into our bodies? Are they bioavailable? What is the nature of them in our water or our air? So one is whether or not we can be exposed to these at levels that would be of concern? And two, if we are exposed to them, is there any risk? Is there any hazard that we need to be knowledgeable about? So that's the kind of research questions that we're asking.
So shifting gears a little bit, I've read and I've heard on the media that natural gas plays a role in our nation's energy future. And in preparation of this show, I'm in no means an expert of hydraulic fracturing, but from what I understand, it is one way of assessing that resource. And in a fiscal year appropriations report, Congress directed EPA to study the relationship between hydraulic fracturing and drinking water. So first, what is hydraulic fracturing? And second, would you tell us more about the EPA study to understand the potential impacts of fracturing on drinking water resources?
Oh, certainly. So hydraulic fracturing is a technique where you can access natural gas by when you drill both vertically as well as horizontally under the surface, that fluids are put into the drilling hole at high pressures in order to fracture or break up the rock, releasing more natural gas to be collected. So this is a very effective way of accessing gas reserves that that has been actually used for many decades, but only in recent years has tremendously increased in its application. So you're correct. Congress did direct the EPA to undertake a scientific assessment, a scientific study of asking the question, are there impacts on drinking water from this practice? So the study design was put together with extensive consultation with experts in the field, from universities, from industry, extensive engagement by the public into the study design. And we have launched into that study design after it was reviewed by our scientific advisory board, so making sure that it's extremely rigorous. And we'll let the science speak for itself. We've got these studies going on. It would be anti-scientific to presuppose the results of this study. And so we're approaching this to ask the right questions, ask the hard questions, and we'll be reporting on the answers as the data becomes available.
Right. So, I mean, we've mentioned hydraulic fracturing. We mentioned nanotechnology. So, and you mentioned earlier about the innovativeness and creativeness of your office. So can you elaborate more on EPA's pursuit of innovative drinking water technology to address the nation's aging water infrastructure?
Oh, certainly. One of the things that the agency is well known for, especially out in our lab out in Cincinnati, is has a long history of pushing the boundaries on new approaches to drinking water and water purification. So we are engaged in not only looking at how we ensure that our aging water infrastructure is able to meet current demands, but also how do we think differently about our water infrastructure more generally? What I mean by that is there has been a history of using drinking water purification plants, treatment plants, wastewater treatment plants, in order to ensure the safety of the nation's drinking water supplies. What has been realized more recently is that a combination of not only the so-called gray infrastructure, water infrastructure, these drinking water plants, but also the green infrastructure of how you use natural systems, wetlands, and different green space in order to contribute to ensuring the purity of the water supply, and how those in combination, the green and the gray, are working in innovative ways. So there's a lot of very thoughtful work being done in partnership with forward-thinking cities and states and making this into a reality.
Right. So you've mentioned the thoughtful work and the importance of these programs. But given the finite resources that are at your disposal now, I mean, how does ORD know to increased scope of a particular program, if you will? How do you know when to decrease the funding or the resources of a program? Or how does, you know, how does ORD prioritize these very important programs?
One of the things the Office of Research and Development always does is recognize that, well, we may have a lot of brilliant scientists and engineers, we also know enough to listen to the people who are the end users of our research. Certainly our program offices, such as the Office of Water, Office of Air, Toxic Substances, and elsewhere, listening to the public. And so when we're designing these programs, we're designing them first and foremost to be as effective in dealing with the questions that the research questions that we identify. And that means getting the synergies, getting the efficiencies of achieving it, especially in a time of constrained resources. But we also want to make sure that we're asking the right questions. So it's one thing to be efficient. It's another thing to make sure that you're heading in the right direction. And so working with our Board of Scientific Counselors, working with the Science Advisory Board is something that we, and many others, is what we do routinely to ensure that we're heading in the right direction.
Paul, given the future-oriented nature of R&D programs, how do you measure return on investment? And more particularly, what are some of the unique challenges you face measuring performance and results within the R&D area?
So especially at a time during shrinking resources, the effectiveness and efficiency of research programs is going to be so important. And as you allude to it, the measurement of research is intrinsically difficult. And one of the things that we always return to is, more than any other metric that we have to put in place, is what positive impact came out of our research. And so it's easy to just measure the number of studies that were completed or the number of reports or papers that we put out. But the true measure that we always want to return to is how many of these projects resulted in implementation and positive impact. And it's returning to those types of things. Did they inform a rule or a guidance document? That's one measure. If they did that result in cleaner air, cleaner water, cleaner land? Did this help inform industry or the public on different ways to approach different issues? And so developing those types of metrics, I think, are, while the most difficult, are also the most important.
Paul, I just have a quick question. It's a follow-up, really, about, with such an important mission, how do you empower your employees to actually achieve their stated goals in research and development? And how do you foster a culture of performance?
Well, it's interesting, because I have been known to repeatedly refer to the mission of the agency of protecting human health and the environment as our sacred mission. And I don't use that term lightly. It's when you think about the nature of that mission, it really is something that is beyond some narrowly defined goal, but it's fundamental to the survival of the people of our nation. So, as well as the environment that sustains life. So it is pretty darn important. And the one good thing is that I'd say everybody at EPA gets that. Everybody in the Office of Research and Development gets that. So the motivation comes from that mission. And so it's the clarity of showing how the work that they're doing relates directly to accomplishing that mission. The more that connection is made crystalline and clear, the motivation stems directly from that.
What does the future hold for research within the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency? We will ask Dr. Paul Anestis, EPA's Assistant Administrator for Research and Development, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. This is The Center This Week, highlighting the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness. brought to you by the IBM Center for the Business of Government. I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Center this week is our opportunity to inform and, most importantly, to invite you, our listeners, to use the IBM Center for the Business of Government as your resource, a how-to resource for improving government effectiveness at the state, local, and federal level. Over the last decade, we had the pleasure to interview government leaders who have offered their extended reflections on the importance of serving the public. In this edition of the Center this week, we offer you a sampling of their insights. As scientist, teacher, and former Undersecretary for Science at the Department of Energy, Dr. Raymond Auerbach brings this point home.
If you think about art and you think about a painting, you're taught that your eye automatically gravitates to the upper right-hand corner. And so the artist then puts together his painting, his tableau, in such a way that your eye is drawn to that corner. If it's not, you're troubled. And the artist can trouble you by coming up with a painting that makes you feel uneasy. Scientists do the same thing. Scientific discovery is not some set of equations that we know and we write down and we solve and eureka. Scientific discovery is coming up with something completely new. Quite often when we discover things, they're so complex and so cumbersome that we wonder whether they really are true or not. And scientists have a tendency to think that they have finally gotten the answer when it's beautiful, when it's simple, when suddenly they see that all of that complexity can be bottled up in a relatively simple expression or simple structure. It's that aesthetic feeling of simplicity that drives discovery and makes one feel that you have created something. I often say to young people, how many fields in the world can you work in that you have a discovery that is yours, that no one can take away from you? You're the one that figured it out, and everybody else who comes along after knows that. That is so exciting. It's also terribly difficult. More often than not, it's very frustrating where you keep going down wrong paths, and you know they're wrong because in order to explain it, it's too complex. There's something wrong out there. So it's that aesthetic sense of simplicity that I think is behind scientific discovery and which keeps us going. Just as exactly as an artist does when they describe their tableau. I view public service as a payback. My own career has been very generously supported by people through their taxes and by our federal government. I view the opportunity of coming to Washington and doing the best job I can as a way of expressing my thanks to this country for the wonderful opportunities it has given me. I would advise young people to get into discovery. It doesn't matter if it's the physical sciences, the mathematics, biological sciences, the science of discovery. It is so exciting, and it has with it a rigor and a process that they will find invaluable in other fields. I would then ask them, over time, to think about payback, about giving this marvelous country of ours a return on its investment in us. That's the way I view federal service, state service, teaching, local service. Each of us expresses our thanks for the support our country has given us through these vehicles.
For the IBM Center for the Business of Government, I'm Michael Keegan, and this has been The Center This Week. Each edition of the Business of Government magazine has as its focus the core mission of the IBM Center, connecting research to practice as a means to improve public management. We do this by bringing together insights and perspectives blended with an equal measure of practicality and reflection from an array of government leaders, public managers, thinkers, and practitioners. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. In an era of fiscal contraction, today's leaders face unique challenges that present many difficult choices. It is a period that, while imposing many constraints, simultaneously confers as many opportunities to make a difference, introduce new ways of managing, explore pragmatic approaches, and pursue management imperatives that help government leaders perform in an ever-challenging, complex environment. In our latest edition, we bring you conversations with FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, outlining the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen. Raphael Boris, DHS Undersecretary for Management, discusses how the department is turning its one DHS vision into a reality. Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York, discusses how the city is shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and efficient. We offer perspectives on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century from Professor Joseph S. Nye, Jr. and General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command. Our forum presents 7 management imperatives that government leaders must pursue to be successful in this new environment. All of this and so much more in the Spring-Summer 2011 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator for Research and Development at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Ken Beecher. So, Paul, I have the pleasure of asking a lot of my guests how they use collaboration and partnerships among agencies and with the private sector to achieve mission results. How are you leveraging partnerships to improve operation and achieve program outcomes at EPA?
So partnership is absolutely essential to EPA accomplishing its mission. We have partnerships with our other federal agencies that's formally coordinated through the National Science and Technology Council. That's something where we discuss priorities, we discuss outcomes, we discuss challenges. We ensure that we don't have duplication of efforts and that we make our efforts as complementary as possible. But partnerships with industry, partnerships with environmental groups and non-governmental organizations, partnerships with universities are also essential. And we have so many of those in terms of cooperative research and development agreements, in terms of agency research grants. And so these partnerships are essential because even though we might have a dedicated workforce that's doing wonderful work, the only way that we're going to be able to accomplish our mission is in partnership with all segments of the American public.
You mentioned earlier about there's a high level of commitment from ORD, and it's easy to embrace, working at EPA, I'm sure it's easy to embrace the mission, right? But having said that, your office requires highly skilled and technical staff. So what are you doing to ensure you have well-trained and technical workforce?
It's a great question because it becomes even more difficult in such a dynamic time where the science is evolving into a new systems approach. We have great chemists, we have great biologists, we have great engineers. As we look to understand how you put these together in systems, it requires an even more complex skill set. So what we do is through our partnerships with universities, for instance, we have in place fellowships. There's what we call STAR fellowships. That's science and technology to achieve results. These fellowships for graduate students not only support their research, but also allow them to become familiar with the different questions and challenges we face, and they become another source of talented scientists and engineers to come into the agency. But one of the most important parts of recruitment is making it clear to the public in general what the EPA does and that EPA is a science agency as well as a regulatory agency. And so too often the work of the EPA is not fully understood. For instance, it's very easy to say that, oh, EPA has some program on particulate matter. But when you say that the air pollution in the form of particulate matter results in and can result in more deaths than breast cancer, prostate cancer, and HIV/AIDS combined, and that we don't know how to cure breast cancer, prostate cancer, or HIV/AIDS, but we do know how to deal with particulate matter. That lets people understand that the work of the agency is often about life and death decisions, often about quality of life and quality of health. When people understand that, they get motivated and want to be part of that workforce. So we're very fortunate in that way.
Right. So you talked about the STAR Fellowship and the work of the agency and actually communicating the science and regulatory boundaries so that you can recruit and retain and recruit the future of scientists and engineers. How do you use the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics or the STEM program in this effort?
Oh, so we have a wide range of support programs for science and technology education materials out of our National Center for Environmental Research. We have we engage through the also through the use of our EPA employees volunteering to go out to schools and give countless lectures right down to K through 12 as well as high schools and college and supporting STEM efforts. There's one particular program that I just find very very exciting that I have I think it's very special. It's called the P3 program. It's People, Prosperity, and the Planet. And this program brings together student design teams around sustainable innovations. So students who are scientists and engineers pull together a team that might have communications folks, artists, folks who might have more of a policy orientation into these teams on how you come up with these new inventions and innovations for either the developing world or even in this country. And every year, these innovations are out on the National Mall, usually around Earth Day, showing off exactly what can come together when you harness the power of students who are engaged in STEM and beyond about how you couple the goals of the EPA with the broader goals of sustainability and economic development and jobs.
So, Paul, as we close our conversation today, I'd like you to think about the future and what are some of the major opportunities and challenges your office will face in the next few years, and how do you think you'll evolve to meet these?
Well, I think the challenges are clear: to continue the sacred mission of EPA in a way that is responsible to the fiscal realities of the budget. We need to, in real time, paying very close attention during these times of tightening budgets. You know, the American people are tightening their belts, and they need to know that the Environmental Protection Agency is tightening its belt. So we're going to look for every opportunity to maintain our effectiveness while being far more efficient in addressing our challenges. And so that is why some of these systems thinking approaches, getting those synergies, making the most of our important partnerships is going to be essential.
So what advice would you have for someone who's thinking about a career in public service?
There are a few things more rewarding than being a public servant. I take those words very seriously, that you are a servant to the public. And that when you think about your life's work and you think about dedicating yourself to something beyond your own interests and trying to make the world a better place, that I know of no better place to accomplish that than the Environmental Protection Agency.
A wonderful way to end. I want to thank you for your time today, Paul, but more importantly, Ken and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And it's an honor for me personally to serve beside the men and women of the EPA, and the American public needs to be assured that they've got people who are dedicated to accomplishing that mission on their behalf.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator for Research and Development and Science Advisor at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has an expansive and varied mission. What is Homeland Security's acquisition strategy? How is DHS enhancing its acquisition oversight? And what is DHS doing to better manage its resources and execute its overall mission? Join host Michael Keegan on the next Business of Government Hour as he explores these questions and so much more with Dr. Nick Nyack, Chief Procurement Officer of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security.